You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Look at any opinion poll, read almost any political column, or turn on a cable news network, and chances are you'll hear about how politically divided our nation has become. In his latest book, Washington Post syndicated columnist and NPR regular commentator E.J. Dionne Jr. looks at why the political divide has gotten so wide and whether differing versions of American history could be to blame. His book, Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent, is now available in paperback from Bloomsbury with a new afterword, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Dionne to our show today. Hello.
What a great joy to be on your show. Thank you very much.
You write that Americans disagree about who we are because we can't agree on where we've been. Has that always been the case?
Well, in fact, we have always argued about the meaning of our history. In the book, I talk about how Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas of the famous debates argued about what the founders actually believed about slavery and what they would do about it. So this is common for us. But the core argument of the book is that this tension is built in us from the beginning, that Americans at one and the same time believe passionately in individualism and liberty and also in community and mutual assistance. And what I think has gone wrong in recent years is that the balance has gotten out of whack, and we have told our story almost entirely on the individual side, forgetting, for example, that the very first word of our Constitution is the word we. It's not I, it's not liberty, it's we the people of the United States. And so the book in some ways could be said to be inspired by the Tea Party. And I do what I will respect about the Tea Party is they want to have an argument about our history. And I think going back to the sources is a good thing. But I have a very different view of what that history is and what the lessons of that history are.
Is this one of the worst times? Of course, you mentioned Lincoln-Douglas debate. The lead-up to the Civil War must have been even worse.
Yes, I think the 1850s, it's funny, as I for the last 5 years, I have found myself reading disproportionately the history of the 1850s, and clearly that was a worse time, although it is striking that some of the same divisions that we had then, particularly a deep regional divide north and south and an ideological divide then, now between, you know, liberals or progressives and conservatives, then between supporters of slavery and those who wanted to restrict it, that some of the same divisions are with us. So it's not that people have big arguments that bother me. I'm for arguments. Arguments are essential to democracy. But I think that by failing to keep into perspective the fact that we are defined by both our desire for liberty and community, we distort the argument, and we become particularly nasty because I think, you know, a progressive ought to be able to say to a conservative, look, I know you care a lot about liberty. So do I. Why don't you acknowledge that? And your history, at least, as conservatism has always been concerned about community. And one of the things that worries me is that I think our great conservative tradition has kind of thrown over the side, for at least for now, this great tradition of caring about how to build community and thinking that that is important to a free society. And I want conservatives to rediscover that part of themselves.
Do you think that the recent financial meltdown intensified the divide, or was it already firmly in place before 2008?
We have been pretty sharply divided going back to the 90s. I mean, there was, after all, the impeachment of Bill Clinton, which I think wasn't just about his behavior. It was about that divide in our politics. But I think the Bush years, the war in Iraq, and the financial meltdown all made this worse. And one of the reasons it made it worse is that a lot of conservatives came to rebel against Bush. I see the Tea Party movement, for example, not only as a reaction to the election of President Obama, but also a take by conservatives on the Bush years that sees Bush as a kind of big government conservative who increased the deficit. Now, those of us on the progressive side would note that a lot of that big government spending was in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nonetheless, I think that the Bush years aggravated this. And obviously, on the progressive side, there was a strong reaction against President Bush. And lay on top of that the fact that Barack Obama is our first African-American president. And I try to be, I've always tried to be very careful in everything I write to make very clear I'm not saying that most opponents of Barack Obama are racist. A lot of people are opposed to Obama because they disagree with his policies. But I think there is an element on some parts of the farther reaches of the right where race does come into it, and we just need to face that. Some conservatives have been quite willing to do so and have denounced that aspect of it while disagreeing with Obama.
At the time of the impeachment hearings, the Clinton hearings, some people suggested that the debate was really over the changes associated with the 1960s.
So, I think that, yeah,
and was that a really a turning point?
The 60s were certainly part of it, and in a funny way, I think you can see the beginning of the rise of a very strong form of individualism, kind of pushing back this communitarian tendency, or if you will, a tendency towards solidarity on both the left and the right. You had a kind of lifestyle individualism on the left and an economic individualism gaining ground on the right. And that's where in the book I talk about how both Obama and Bill Clinton understood that some of the attack on liberalism was an attack on a sense that liberalism itself had lost its connection with community. Certainly the New Deal and FDR's speeches were vitally concerned with community. And so, you know, Clinton talked about opportunity, responsibility, community. Some of that was political sloganeering, but I think some of it was an honest effort to come to terms with the problems of radical individualism on the center-left in a way that I now very much think conservatives need to come to terms with their own forms of radical individualism.
You write about how Americans fear that we could go into further decline. Are the narratives two competing arguments for how to avoid that decline?
I think in some ways that's right. I think that the issue of decline has been the underlying and sometimes, though not always, unspoken fear that's dominated our politics, and that when we go through the – I am not a declinist, by the way. I think that if we get our politics straight, we are going to be a free, prosperous, and very influential country for a long time. But we've been in a declinist mood, both because of the economy and because of reaction against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And when we get in these moods, we tend to get into a kind of spiritual crises. And I think Barack Obama clearly understood that in the 2008 campaign. When you think back to the slogans in his campaign, there was that poster with the single word hope on it. And change we can believe in. And I always thought believe was at least as important as the word change in that slogan. Hope and believe were about a spiritual crisis. And I think the Tea Party similarly was speaking to that sense of decline, or was motivated by a fear of decline. But as I say, I think it's we mislead ourselves if we think that somehow American decline is inevitable. I just don't believe that.
Well, a listener has written in saying, it's not just history. We are working with different facts on just about every pertinent issue of the day.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book is I was trying to lay out facts of the American story. I quote a lot of historians in the book. In some ways, the book is a tribute to great American historians. And I think that we tend to misread our past as much as we misread the present. But I think the listener may be referring to the fact that in our political debate, things that aren't facts at all tend to be believed as facts by one side of it. I am on the progressive side of politics at the moment. I think that is happening more on the right side than on the left side. But it's not a very constructive way to do politics. I think I sympathize with the implicit critique of the listener of existing reality by saying we need to go back to a time where at least we can say these are the facts, these are the problems, now let's argue about how to solve them as opposed to pretending that things presented as fact that are untrue are in fact true.
My guest is E.J. Dionne, Jr. His book, Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent, has just been issued in paperback by Bloomsbury with a new afterword by the author. Were the populist movement in the progressive era the high watermark of the community narrative?
Well, I think that narrative really dominated our story right through the 1960s. The way I see our history is that it's a history of balance between community and individualism, and liberty and solidarity. And that we had a brief interlude during the Gilded Age, roughly the period from after the end of the Civil War to the rise of Teddy Roosevelt, where radical individualism really was in the saddle. It's, by the way, in that period when corporations were declared people.
The age of the robber barons.
Yes, the age of the robber barons. And the populists first and then the progressives arose in reaction to this concentration of economic power and this this idea that we should only view ourselves as individual actors in a marketplace. A lot of my friends on the right tend to view this, the populists and the progressives, as the beginning of a brand new period of big government. I argue that, on the contrary, the populists and progressives are actually renewing the long tradition of balance that you saw in figures such as Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, and Abraham Lincoln. Henry Clay believed passionately that the federal government had an important role to play in building our economy. He actually called it the American system to distinguish it from British laissez-faire. President Lincoln obviously believed in a strong nation. He led a war to defend that nation, and also an active federal government. So I see the populists and progressives leading into the New Deal establishing this long tradition of balance. And I think in the last 5 or 10, 15 years, it's that tradition of balance that's been under attack. I refer to it in the book as the long consensus. I think that long consensus was on the ballot in 2012, and the long consensus won. And I think the Americans did opt again for this balance as opposed to this extreme individualism.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt was also a Republican, although, as you point out, that in the period between Lincoln and Roosevelt's presidency, we had the era, the Golden Age, the era of the robber barons. But was Teddy Roosevelt's, was the Republican Party different at the turn of the century, or was he an anomaly?
I mean, the Republican Party was very different. It's always had a strong conservative wing, but it was also home to some of the most progressive people in the country. It might be of interest to New Yorkers that Jacob Javits, the former Republican senator from New York, plays a rather important role in a part of the book, because he, too, looks back at this Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln tradition as being very important. And there used to be a very substantial body of progressive opinion in the Republican Party. It is this part of the Republican Party that helped get us the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, when a significant share of the Democratic Party was made up of Southern segregationists. And what you've had systematically is an exit or a driving out, I think the two go together, of many of these moderate to progressive voices in the Republican Party. And I think when you listen to some of the staunchest or most extreme conservatives, they kind of want to write Teddy Roosevelt out of the party, too.
And they want to write Chuck Hagel out of the party, too. But we'll talk about that in a moment.
That's right. And to me, again, just as I think conservatism needs to rediscover its communitarian side, I'd like to see the Republican Party rediscover a certain moderation, particularly in its attitude toward the role of government.
My guest is E.J. Dionne, Jr., columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, university professor in the Foundations of Democracy and Culture at Georgetown University, appears weekly on NPR and regularly on MSNBC and NBC's Meet the Press. And his book, Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent, has just been reissued in a paperback edition by Bloomsbury. It has a new afterword by the author. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with E.J. Dionne, Jr. His book, Our Divided Political Heart, has just been issued in a paperback edition by Bloomsbury with a new afterword by the author. Richard Nixon signed the EPA and other conservation legislation into law. Did everything change during Ronald Reagan's two terms?
You know, it's funny. I've heard some historians describe Nixon as the last liberal president, which, of course, takes many liberals by surprise.
Well, but Tom Wicker said that.
Tom Wicker. Thank you. Because when you look at the legislation that he signed, passed, it should be said, by a Democratic Congress, it's quite extraordinary. I think it began to change under Ronald Reagan. But in effect, the roots of this conservative revolt were back in the 1950s, and even to some degree, you can see the beginnings of it in the revolt against the New Deal. A great historian called Philip Spine wrote a book about the origins of the New Deal in this business opposition to it. But the 50s are important, and I talk some about Bill Buckley, and here is where I think you see it's Kim Phillips Fine, by the way, whom I mentioned earlier. Here's where I think you see how radical conservatism has become, because on the one hand, Bill Buckley wanted a fairly pure, reasonably libertarian conservative movement, but he was also someone who believed strongly in community obligation. He wrote, before he died, a book called Gratitude, in which he talked about what we owe back to the country that has nurtured us and protected us. And I think a lot of the ideas Buckley presented in Gratitude, kind of a communitarian view, would now be rejected by the right. So that I think what you had is a push that began in the 50s, reached a certain culmination with Reagan. But what's happened with the Tea Party has gone far beyond where Ronald Reagan was or what Ronald Reagan tried to do. You know, you see it most markedly on the issue of raising taxes, where Reagan was actually willing to raise taxes, and he actually joked about the surprise that he would do that and sort of kind of denied he was doing it even as he was doing it. But he was willing to raise taxes when the budget went crazy. And now, until this last budget deal, there was an absolute rejection of that idea. So it began with Reagan, but I think we move beyond Reagan. And when Reagan starts looking like a more moderate figure, that should tell us something about what's happened to our friends on the conservative side, or some of them.
After the Tea Party emerged following the 2008 election, it put a lot of emphasis on the story of the country's earliest days. How have they portrayed the country's founding?
Well, the liberty is obviously the key word, and they view the Constitution primarily as a negative document. I mean that word neutrally. That is to say, a negative document that's primarily designed to preserve negative liberty, freedom from. And I think what's wrong with that view is, first, at the most basic, the Constitution was enacted to replace the Articles of Confederation because the founders, the people who wrote the Constitution, thought our national federal government was not strong enough. They view the Constitution as having a states' rights view that the country essentially rejected after the Civil War. We fought a whole civil war over the idea of whether the federal government was entirely a creature of the states and therefore states could secede, and we said no as a nation at the end of that war.
Are you surprised that people are talking about secession again?
I am and I'm not. I am because we did all think we settled that. I'm not because their theoretical view of the Constitution is very similar to the view of Calhoun and later secessionists. So it is a kind of logical part of their view, which is what I think others should realize in assessing what they are actually arguing, that this is, in a broad sense, I think, a view rejected by a very substantial majority of Americans, including a lot of conservatives.
Has each narrative appealed to people living in different parts of the country? Does community tend to appeal to urban Americans and individualism to those who live in rural areas?
Well, you certainly are pointing to what voting patterns look like right now, where obviously Democrats are doing much better in urban and suburban areas and Republicans in rural areas. But historically, that's not true. that hasn't been us, that the idea of community has been very strong in rural areas. Populism was a rural revolt. And in the book, I take some of my fellow progressives to task for ever using the term flyover country to refer to the rest of America, as if all that matters are the two coasts. When you look at some of the most vibrant movements for reform, both populist and progressive, it arose in states like Kansas and Nebraska, as well as states like Minnesota and the Dakotas and Wisconsin. And so it is not in the nature of rural areas to reject community. In fact, the old tradition of we all come together to help build the neighbor's barn, it's deep in our folklore, but there was a reality to it. But I think right now we are very divided, with conservatism being particularly strong in rural America.
But that La Follette sensibility has kind of died out and led Thomas Frank to write that his famous book, Whatever Happened to Kansas?
No, that's true, it's true and it's not. You still see in the Dakotas, for example, the Dakotas were represented by progressive senators, and there are still important progressive politicians there, people who in some ways trace their roots back to the old nonpartisan league of the progressive farmers' revolt. Obviously, Minnesota and Wisconsin still have very strong progressive traditions. And you briefly, even in Kansas, had a revolt against the takeover of the Republican Party by extreme right elements. You had a lot of Republicans defecting, which is why our current Secretary of HHS, Kathleen Sebelius, got elected governor. So we haven't lost all of this. But yes, there has been a movement. And one of the things I argue, I talk about Tom Frank's book, which I respect very much, agree with in part, but disagree with in part. I think that progressives kind of lost their gift for talking about community in ways that are compelling to some of those voters in Kansas, and they need to find it again. I think Obama and Clinton were both struggling for that language, and I think there's still the language and the ideas behind it, and I think that struggle is still on.
Well, his argument was that social issues became really important, issues like abortion. And I don't know whether we include abortion into community or into individual.
No, well, I think abortion is one of the most difficult issues we have for two reasons. One is a friend of mine, Kathleen Cavaney, who teaches at Notre Dame, notes that you're talking about the rights of the most vulnerable people, if you believe the fetus is a person, and the very nearly the second most vulnerable person, which is a pregnant mother. And you have a fundamental conflict of rights here. And there are some progressive right-to-lifers who are profoundly communitarian, both in their attitude toward abortion and in their attitude toward social provision. But that's the other problem, is that each side has its particular brand of individualism, and individual autonomy is a very powerful idea among liberals. I would love the discussion of abortion to focus more than it does on the question of, well, what do we do for those women who actually would like to give birth to their children? To say abortion should be illegal and then provide little help for women who choose to have their children strikes me as a very inconsistent position. And I don't talk a lot about abortion in my book, but I've written about it over the years, and I very much wish we could have a discussion of abortion that was informed by both autonomy and solidarity.
E.J. Dionne Jr.'s latest book is Our Divided Political Heart, now available in a paperback edition from Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The collapse of the debt ceiling negotiations in 2011 seemed to be a turning point for President Obama. Has he changed his approach to dealing with Congress?
Yeah, I think the answer is clearly yes. And everything we see in public and everything I understand that I have learned as a journalist is that he made a fundamental choice after the end of the debt ceiling. He understood that he conveyed an impression to both his critics and some of his supporters of weakness. The administration defends itself by saying they could not allow the country to go over that particular cliff, and that they got a reasonable deal at the end. Nonetheless, I think he understood at that point that in its current form, the Republican Party in Congress, dominated by a certain kind of conservatism, could not be negotiated with in the way that he hoped. He had promised an era of bipartisanship, and if one party to that doesn't want to cooperate, you're not going to pull it off. And so from that moment on, he began to say, there's a big argument in the country. I'm going to make my case and hope that I win it. One of his most significant speeches was in Osawatomie, Kansas, which is where Teddy Roosevelt gave a famous speech in 1910 announcing the new nationalism, which is really one of the first strong, here is what American progressives want to do kind of speech. I joke with friends at the time that other than the Osawatomie Chamber of Commerce, I was probably happier than anyone that Obama went there, because I was finishing my book, and it was very much in keeping with the theme of the book. And I think you've seen him make a case all the way through for a balanced view of government, a balanced view of how to take on the deficit, and a very aggressive argument that government has a role to play in solving social problems, in containing excesses of concentrated economic power. And that's the argument that I think he won by not a landslide, but by a very significant margin in the 2012 election. I like to say people argue, does he have a mandate or not? And I think the word mandate just gets us off into an argument about what exactly did the voters say. The way I prefer to put it is we had a big argument as a country, and the voters settled that argument. Now we have to move forward from that settlement.
Well, it's often argued that people vote against rather than vote for, and Mitt Romney and his running mate Paul Ryan were emphasizing the individual. They later, at least Romney later, backtracked on the 47%. But do you think that the public was disturbed by that?
I think that the 47% moment was one of the most important moments of the campaign, because it captured something about Mitt Romney's worldview that voters already suspected. I think events in campaigns tend to have the most power when they sort of confirm something voters already feel. And I think that by putting Ryan on the ticket, Paul Ryan, who had once been a devotee of the ideas of Ayn Rand, certainly a radical individualist if ever there was one, really gave the country a very, very clear choice. And so, in a sense, I do believe the negative verdict the country made against that particular collection of ideas, even at a time, by the way, when Obama was defending an economy where unemployment was still close to 8%, that the voters rendered that negative verdict tells us where the country doesn't want to go. And it's now up to progressives to define the direction that we should take. If I can add something very quickly, in the afterword of the book, I talk about how a friend of mine who read the book before it came out, went to a Bruce Springsteen concert and said, there is a song here that is the theme of your book that Obama ought to use. And she turned out to be a prophet. It was the song on the Wrecking Ball album where Bruce Springsteen sings, "We Take Care of Our Own." And in the afterword of the book, I talk about this as the "We Take Care of Our Own" election.
The debate over gun control that was forced upon us by the events in Newtown, Connecticut, is that an example of the difference between these two narratives?
I very much think so. In fact, I think it's a particularly powerful example where one side of the argument is really saying we all should be armed because we should all defend ourselves as individuals. The other side of the argument is saying we need to have regulation of weaponry, and in the case of assault weapons in the big magazines, we need to have government ban certain forms of weaponry, because none of us will ever succeed in defending ourselves. This is not Lebanon during the Civil War, where I happened to do some work back in the 1980s. This is not a society in which this will defend us. Indeed, there's a lot of evidence that having a gun in your home may create more danger rather than more safety. And so this is a classic case of that argument. And on guns, there has been a kind of disconnect because a very substantial percentage of Americans, even those who believe there is a Second Amendment right to bear arms, don't believe there's a right to have assault weapons, don't believe in an unregulated marketplace. But this very, very right-wing view has been far more dominant in the discourse, and it took the horrible tragedy in Connecticut, I think, to shake up the political world. President Obama was certainly not out front on this issue at all. He was reluctant to join it until after this tragedy happened, but I'm very grateful personally that he has.
And now they've released a photograph of him shooting a rifle. Last week, a bipartisan group of senators laid out a plan for immigration reform. Do you think that any meaningful reform package will emerge in light of what we've been talking about?
I'm guardedly optimistic. I mean, we don't repeat history exactly as it happens, but in that old line, history does rhyme. And we have had many moments in our past where we've had strong nativist sentiment, a strong reaction against immigrants. A lot of people didn't like the Irish coming in, or the Italians, or the Jews, or the Poles coming into the country. And eventually, we realized that there is a powerful American idea that no matter where we come from, no matter what color we are, people who come to America really want to embrace that idea, even as they add variations to it. And I think this election showed that Obama, on the one hand, running as an advocate of immigration reform, of finding a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants, won the election. And he did not seem to lose a lot of votes because of that stand. Mitt Romney, using terms like self-deportation, actually alienated a large number of Latinos who in the past had given many more votes. They've been a Democratic group as a whole. But they had given, President Bush, for example, up to 40% of their votes. Romney went down to 27%. I think Republicans realize that they can't hold to the positions that many in the party have held to and win national elections as the country becomes more diverse. And this has happened before as parties came to terms with other new arrivals on our shores.
EJ, just one more question. Gallup announced last month that Congress's average approval rating for last year was 15%, the lowest in the 38 years that they've been asking that polling question. So is this one area where people on the left and the right are in agreement?
There's somebody, I think a comedian said, I really want to find out who those 15% actually are.
Members of Congress and their families.
Yeah, that's right. I think I think something's going to happen on guns. We may not get the assault weapons ban. I think there is a good chance that they will pass pass legislation to close the loopholes on background checks and possibly a ban on big magazines. And similarly, I think there is a very good shot at immigration reform. Senator Schumer in New York has worked closely with Lindsey Graham and a whole group of senators. I think we're closer now than we have been in a long time. Nothing is easy in Washington anymore. But I do think on both of these issues, there is a real shot at progress. And I have to believe that we will soon enough decide we cannot have a government by emergency with new budget fights every 3 months. You can't run any organization, any business, the way we've been trying to run the federal government. And at some point, I think even Congress will get sick of this. Even Republicans in Congress will get sick of this.
E.J. Dionne Jr. is a columnist for The Washington Post. His twice-weekly op-ed column is now syndicated in 140 newspapers. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and university professor at the Foundations of Democracy and Culture at Georgetown University. Appears weekly on NPR, regularly on MSNBC and NBC's Meet the Press. And his most recent book is Our Divided Political Heart, now available in a paperback edition from Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us again.
A great joy to be with you. Thank you.